We are charging hard into the Independence Day holiday. We've got a great success story, a look at a hot weather forecast, and we're going to be talking to a flag maker. How cool is that? Stocks are higher. The market got really good jobs report for June, and the optimism in stocks is slipping right over to the cattle complex.
Live from Dawn Patrol headquarters via Farm Journal broadcast, this is AgriTalk. This morning we begin with a conversation with Grant Kimberly from the Iowa Biodiesel Board. Then we've got Ed Valley from Empire Weather. And in the final segment from Valley Forge Flags, Jeff Schaber. And right after the news, Greg Henderson from Drovers checks in. I'm handsome newsman Davis Michelson, and now the host of AgriTalk, Chip Flory.
All right, regular listeners, I know, might be saying to themselves, wait a second, I thought we were going to hear Senator Pat Roberts this morning. We previewed that a couple of times yesterday.
We did.
Schedules change in the Senate. And we understand that, and we appreciate that. And we look at it as an opportunity. An opportunity to upgrade, perhaps, for many people, getting Ed Valley from Empire Weather in here to talk about what this weather forecast is going to be for the second half of July. That is as equally important as what we would have talked about with Senator Roberts. And, Senator Roberts did say that he regrets not being able to be on the show, and he's looking forward to getting back on with us here sometime soon.
You know, Chip, with irregardless now in the dictionary, can we change the word opportunity to an agritunity, perhaps?
Agritunity. No.
No?
No, we shouldn't mess with words like that. You know, like even the advocacy, I can't hardly even say that.
Oh, yeah, no, that one
let
I don't care for.
Let alone be one.
Right, right. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Shoot. Now, there's nothing wrong with being an advocate for agriculture. But
No, not at all.
An advocate is, you know, I acknowledge that we need to sometimes put a spin on words.
Hey, suggestion for you, America, for this holiday weekend. If you really, really want to fire yourself up on America, put on some Night Ranger first thing in the morning, as loud as she'll go, Dawn Patrol, Midnight Madness, all of those. I mean, it's all really, really great stuff. And I would remind, you can still rock in America.
Yes. Yeah, very good. See, to me, this weekend is all about Kid Rock.
Oh, very good. Yeah.
I mean, some Nickelback will slide in there only because I'm a fun lover. But does feel more like a Kid Rock weekend to me.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, it was Canada Day, yesterday? So you can have a little Nickelback in there.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Why not? All right, let's get to the news. What do you got?
Well, Chip, EPA Administrator Andrew Wheeler will make no announcement regarding the wave of retroactive hardship waivers received of late, as his agency has not yet been given assessments of the situation by the Department of Energy. Earlier this week, we reported Senator Joni Ernst's refusal to clear the nomination of Doug Benevento for the post of Deputy EPA Administrator until those 52 requests are addressed. Now, Senator Ted Cruz of Texas has joined Ernst's hard line, citing the rise in renewable identification numbers, or RINs. Cruz was quoted as saying, until EPA Administrator Andrew Wheeler delivers on his promise to take actions that help bring stability to the price of RINs, I will not allow this nomination to move forward. Chip!
Can you imagine being Benevento and are getting squeezed from both sides on this?
Yeah. Yeah,
this topic is exactly where we're going to start with Grant Kimberly when we get him on here in just a few minutes.
Good, good. Well, Chip, the U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement went into effect yesterday, but ongoing tensions over tariffs and other issues, which had prolonged the negotiation process, are complicating a smooth rollout of the accord. Disputes over auto manufacturing and concerns over aluminum and metals tariffs remain. Labor standards in Mexico are also a point of contention. Labor groups in the U.S. fear Mexico will not comply with the required improvements for the Mexican labor force. And there's a lot more to it than those issues, but those are the ones in the spotlight now.
Yeah, yeah, and this trade agreements are very much trust but verify. Trust but verify. We are continually looking to verify that the terms of the agreement are being respected, are being implemented in our partner countries. So we're going to continue to hear about things like this. And I think the labor issues in Mexico could be maybe the most dicey one here for the moment, but we're going to continue to watch it closely.
Well, the U.S. has postponed flights back to their posts in China for several U.S. diplomats. This after failing to come to an agreement on issues including COVID-19 testing and quarantine. In addition, the U.S. is said to be preparing to introduce sanctions over human rights abuses perpetrated by Beijing. The House passed a bill imposing sanctions on banks doing business with Chinese officials involved in cracking down on pro-democracy advocates in Hong Kong. And on June 22nd, the U.S. issued a new determination to designate four additional Chinese media agencies as foreign missions and ship in retaliation. I didn't list them out, but China says, well, look, then we're going to list a few of your own journalistic houses as foreign missions of the U.S.
Yeah, yeah. And Larry Kudlow was on the news channels this morning talking about the jobs report that was very positive. But China continues to come up. The and the latest was Kudlow saying something about, well, we're not going to let Huawei be part of our 5G infrastructure out there. So, yeah, the tensions are high, dude.
Well, quickly here, California Governor Gavin Newsom plans to announce fresh lockdown measures in that state in response to the recent surge in infections. Apple has announced it will reclose 30 U.S. retail outlets in seven states. And McDonald's is also postponing reopening dining areas in its U.S. restaurants by 3 weeks. Chip.
Starts and fits. Fits and starts. Yep. All right. Thanks, Davis. Let's bring in Greg Henderson, the editorial director at Drovers. How you doing there, Greg?
Good morning, Chip. You know, I'm not having to scoop any snow this morning.
Oh, good. Good. That's good to hear.
It's plenty warm and humid where I'm at, and I'd just like to turn it down just a little bit.
Just a bit. Yeah, I hear you, man. I hear you. Hey, the upheaval that this cattle industry has gone through in the first half of 2020, we've never experienced anything like this for sure, but is it having an impact on the plans of cow-calf producers?
Yes, and we're seeing evidence starting to mount. Beginning of the year, we said that the expansion phase was probably over. The analysts expected the markets to be steady to slightly better this year. We know that didn't happen. Now we're looking at a cattle inventory that's changed dramatically, and liquidation may be underway. So reasons are, obviously, fed cattle prices are at a 10-year low, and there's little incentive for ranchers to grow the cow herd. We have drought in six of the top 10 beef cow states, and the final thing is January 1 beef cow numbers were at 31.3 million, and cow slaughter through mid-June has averaged 60,000 head a week. That's 2.3% higher than last year, so we've already got a relatively low number of cows, and we're killing more of them. Right. Heifers comprise 37.6% of the slaughter mix, and there's an old rule of thumb that says when they go above 36% of the slaughter mix, liquidation has started. So we're seeing plenty of evidence. Three weeks from now, we'll have a report from USDA. Let us know.
Right, exactly. Okay, thanks, Greg. Appreciate it, buddy. Yeah, we got to watch that. We got a cycle low coming up in 2 or 3 years here. So thanks, man. We'll talk to you later. We've got Grant Kimberly up next on AgriTalk. Everyone talks big yields, but Channel Seedsmen deliver advice that yields results. Every season, Channel Seedsmen match elite seed products with unmatched service and support to push the performance of every acre. That's why you can count on Channel for what you need to make the most of your season. You don't have to be a Channel customer to take advantage of this support. Visit channel.com/agritalk to sign up and receive expert advice that yields.
I'm Andrew McRae, inviting you to join me for Farming the Countryside, a farmer-focused podcast important to agriculture. It's brought to you by Pivot BioProven. Visit pivotbio.com to find a representative near you.
All right, welcome back to AgriTalk. Glad that you could join us today. We're heading into the weekend. Markets close early today. The grains close at 12:05. Livestock trade closes at 12:15. Don't forget that. So if you've got something that you need to get done in the markets today, get it done. Okay. I'm really looking forward to this conversation. Grant Kimberly is the CEO of the Iowa Biodiesel Board. He joins us right now. Grant, it is good to talk with you again. How are you?
Doing really good, Chip. It's great to be back with you.
Yeah, good deal,
Looking forward to this weekend for sure, getting together with family and enjoying some family time, definitely, for the 4th of July.
Yeah, okay, well, let's go down this path then real quick. Davis is looking at a Night Ranger weekend.
I'm thinking that Kid Rock
is probably going to be dominating the airtime on my radio. How about you?
We will be enjoying some of those great fireworks that now we are allowed to legally do in Iowa over the 4th of July. So every young boy is a pyro at heart, and so this just is a great thing. I love to be able to do this, so we're looking forward to that, and the whole family is as well.
Excellent. All right. So we've got a lot of ground that I want to cover. Senator Ernst, she's taking a stand at EPA, but so is Senator Cruz. He's now putting a hold on Benevento until relief is provided to small refiners. Okay, Grant, here's your opportunity. Number one, message to Senator Ernst, and maybe a counter message to Senator Cruz.
Well, certainly, Senator Ernst, we are so grateful for her leadership on this and for her willingness to really step out and make a strong statement. Senator Grassley's right there supporting her as well. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we're very grateful that she's doing this. And so, we're just lucky we have a senator like her representing our state and our industry. Right. Now, Senator Cruz, that's another story. I don't know where to really begin with him because he is just a different kind of senator. So I just hope he doesn't plan to run for president again, because I don't think he'll be too welcome in the state of Iowa if he does that, because he just is one of those senators where he's just constantly pushing against our industry. But you know what? In the end, from my understanding, Cruz won't be able to have the opportunity to put a hold on Benevento since it's not moving out of committee in the first place. That's really his only path was to do that once it moved out of committee. So if it doesn't even move out of committee, then it's kind of a moot point.
Yeah, and that's where Senator Ernst has grabbed hold of it in the committee. She was on AgriTalk earlier this week talking about it, and I've seen a couple of news clips since she was on the show with us, Grant, and she's not backing off at all. She wants to know what the plans are for those gap year SRE requests, and I think everybody wants to know what the plan is. I think even the folks at EPA want to know what the plan is, because they're waiting for the evaluation from, is it OMB that they're waiting for the evaluation on it from?
They're actually at DOE right now. So the process is that it goes to DOE first, and so they're looking at these. But definitely, I mean, everybody says that the law of the land is what the Tenth Circuit Court put into place, and really there's no way to prove that there's a hardship in those gap waivers in the first place. Right. The RIN numbers have expired. They don't even go back past 2018. So how can you show if you had a hardship way back in 2012? It just doesn't make any sense at all. So, you know, we're hopeful that they'll continue to look at this, you know, just from a logical standpoint and reject these out of hand.
It's just another obstacle that they are throwing up in front of this. And it gets frustrating, doesn't it?
Yeah, I feel like we've been fighting against this nonstop for the last couple of years. And, you know, we feel like we make progress, and then something else happens and kind of takes us back a step. But every time, you know, we keep plugging ahead and moving forward. And I think we've got, you know, a lot of strong advocates on our side here. And, you know, our senators, as I've said earlier, and Governor Reynolds here in the state of Iowa has been very helpful. And so, you know, all those things are what we're using to move this forward. And we've got the law on our side too. I mean, obviously everything, the logic, the law, everything's on our side here. So, we just have to continue to move forward.
Excellent. Excellent. Speaking of Iowa Governor Reynolds, weren't you with her earlier this week?
Yeah, I was. I happened to get the opportunity to spend some time with her up at Pine Lake Corn Processors. It was an ethanol plant in north central Iowa, and we did a bill signing there along with other leaders from the Iowa legislature and the Iowa biofuels and renewable fuels industry and agriculture industries. And we basically got to celebrate the bill that she signed. It was an extension of a tax differential bill that we have for renewable fuels in the state of Iowa. What it did is it extended a 3-cent reduction or differential in a B11 or higher credit for biodiesel blended diesel fuel at 11%. And then there also was an extension for in a modification made on the ethanol side for reduction in the tax credit or the fuel tax differential when it came to E15. So we talked about that. And then also she talked about infrastructure in Iowa. We have some cost share dollars available where retailers can access those dollars, get 50% cost share, and put in biofuel blending infrastructure for biodiesel and ethanol, and that's usually a $3 million allocation in the budget every year, but of course with COVID, none of that was certain, but they did continue to hold that into the budget and put that forward for this next year. In addition to that, the state gets some CARES Act dollars that they have flexibility on, and she made the announcement at this event that she's going to add an additional $7 million into that program for infrastructure investment. So a total of $10 million for that. And then we've got the fuel tax differential, you know, and then you've got the federal, you've got the USDA HBIP dollars too, the infrastructure dollars through that program. So when you throw all those things together, you know, a lot of good things are happening and we're seeing biofuels really move forward in a positive way in the state of Iowa.
Yeah, definitely. What's the retailer interest in those dollars and the cost share? Are they taking the steps that they need to make those products available?
Yeah, they are. And that's part of the stipulation, too. They have to agree to offer ethanol and biodiesel blends if they take those dollars to upgrade their infrastructure, blending, blender pumps, terminals, heated terminals, those kinds of things. So they have to continue to offer it. And what we've noticed over the last several years when this has been in place, you know, we've seen about 57% of all the diesel fuel used in the state of Iowa now contains a B11 or higher blend of biodiesel in it now. So we've really seen a huge, huge increase. And just the tax credits that we've had in place in the state of Iowa kind of helps smooth out that federal policy uncertainty a little bit, at least on a local level. So we continue to see the industry move forward, you know, in our state, even when we have these federal challenges.
Right, right. Okay. You know, there's lots of different state programs out there that are in place, and we can talk about those at some point, Grant, but this is so important to the not just the soybean industry in the state of Iowa, but we can't forget that we're also pulling corn oil off of the ethanol plants and turning that into biodiesel too, right?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, the diversity of the biodiesel sector and renewable diesel sector when it comes to the feedstock side is one of our strong selling points. We have a lot of different options there. Certainly soybean oil is the number one feedstock over.
Right.
It's about over 50% of all the biodiesel produced in the country has soybean oil in it, or it's made from soybean oil. But corn oil is a key component, and that helps diversify, you know, for corn farmers and for the ethanol industry as well. So that's a sizable, very important feedstock for us. And of course, we're talking about animal fats for the livestock sector, pork, beef, poultry fats. All those things play into it as well. They're a major component. And then you've got, you know, canola is another one, too. So we just have lots of different options when it comes to feedstocks. But all of those all come back to the farmer.
Yeah, exactly. How much is it worth?
Well, you know, for the soybean producer, it's about a little over a dollar a bushel is what studies have shown. So it's really important, you know, for our soybean industry, especially in light of when you have trade issues and uncertainties there. And you want to have a strong domestic market, and this provides one of those good outlets for our domestic producers. And in addition to that, it helps the livestock guys because it adds to the carcass value by adding value to the animal fat. And then it lowers soybean meal prices too, because if you raise the value of the oil and the crush, you're going to a little bit lower the value of the or the contributing factor of the meal. So, you know, it's good for livestock producers by reducing feed prices.
Yep, very cool. Boy, I tell you, a buck
lots
a bushel.
Of good things.
Yeah, a buck a bushel, turn that into a revenue per acre. We're talking 60, 70 bucks an acre for a lot of guys. That's an important contributor. Boy, that's impressive. Thanks,
right.
Grant. We'll talk to you later. Have a great 4th of July.
Sounds good. You guys, too. Thanks a lot.
All right, that is Grant Kimberly, the CEO of the Iowa Biodiesel Board.
Time for Markets Now with the experts from Pro Farmer.
And joining us now is Pro Farmer editor Brian Grady. Brian, it was a rocket shot in corn prices earlier this week. Just a bit of a setback here going into the weekend.
Yeah, Chip, we're pulling back on some profit taking. Probably not too surprising. We ran up to the highest level since late March in corn futures. And so ahead of the long weekend here, they are pulling back some, like I said. We do still have forecasts coming out of the 4th of July calling for hot and mostly dry conditions. So we'll see. And they probably want to see how the weather forecasts develop over the long weekend before reassessing positions next week.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. We're going to be talking with Ed Valley from Empire here in just a moment about that. Take us over to the wheat market. What's happening there?
Well, the wheat's been supported this week by the strength in corn and soybeans, and we don't have that this morning. And as a result, the wheat market, it's under pressure, pretty heavy pressure, actually. You know, with the winter wheat markets leading us down amid the harvest activity. And that's, you know, typical seasonal pressure that we're seeing in the wheat market. Like I said, if it wasn't for corn this week, wheat would have probably been lower.
Hey, we had some export demand announced this morning. Talk about that.
Yeah, we had about 4 cargoes of new crop corn to China and 2 cargoes of new crop soybeans to China. So we are seeing that Chinese business. We haven't had many daily sales here recently, but we did get those announcements this morning. Unfortunately, not supporting the price tone.
Jobs data supporting cattle?
I think a little bit. And then the fact that the corn market is off, that kind of triggered a rebound in feeder cattle, which caught a bit in the live cattle market as well there.
All right, yeah, and we've got hogs under a little bit of pressure going into the weekend despite some really good export sales. Have a great 4th, Brian. We'll talk to you next week.
Opinions expressed on AgriTalk do not necessarily reflect the views of Farm Journal Broadcasting, affiliate stations, or sponsors. I don't know what you're thinking! So call us at 855-4-TALK-AG and tell us what's on your mind.
Davis, I'm a little bit concerned that we're not going to be able to hear the corn conga this No, you know what? We will, because I'll have the weekly changes for us. We can do the corn
conga right
during the
weekly
changes.
I'll play it right now, baby. I don't care. I'm not even looking at the markets and I'm playing the corn conga. I mean, just on the basis of this week alone, why not?
That's right. That's right.
So
we got the acreage report out earlier this week. That was the big catalyst for the move in the corn market that we've seen. We've got some export demand that is coming in. We've got the funds that are stepping out of the short side of the market. Hopefully they're getting moving over to neutral and will find a reason to get onto the long side of the market. But everybody that I've talked to this week, Davis, says what we've done so far has factored all of that in to the corn market. Going forward, if this market's going to continue to go to the upside, it's going to be because there are some concerns over yields dependent on the weather. So let's get in
that
ballot.
Enough. Yeah, but it almost sounds like maybe you need to hang out with some new people, Chip. I mean, come on. At least one or two. Let's find some bullish friends for you. What do you say?
Hey, you got to be careful what you ask for there, newsman. All right, let's bring in Ed Valley, Empire Weather Consulting. Ed, thanks for making time for us this morning. How you doing?
Oh, hang in there, Chip. How are you?
I'm doing okay. It's going to get warm here again today, and it sounds like it's going to get warm for a while.
Yeah, I tell you what. I mean, we had a really nice end of June with some of that moisture coming in and some of those cooler temperatures. But I tell you, moving into the fourth and beyond here, I think we are, just like you said, we're going to get pretty darn warm.
Yeah. Okay. Now, I got to throw this out there, and I've thrown it out there a couple of times earlier this week. When we talk about warm temperatures in July, I don't want to hear this, well, it is July. It is supposed to be warm. Because what we're really looking at is the departure from normal. And in much of the Corn Belt, Ed, aren't we looking at temperatures that are going to be somewhere between 5 and 8 degrees above normal?
Yeah, that's exactly right, Chip. And okay. For just some context for you, when you're looking at normal, right, it is July's the hottest time of the year. Yep. A normal high temperature in Des Moines, for example, through the month of July is about 86 degrees with a low of about 67, okay? Now, moving east, you go into, let's say, Indianapolis. It's 85 with a low of 66. So that's kind of our baseline here. And you're exactly right. I think as we move forward here, the air mass we're going to be seeing is certainly one that's anomalously warm. A lot of 5 to 10 degree above normal risk in the next 10 to 15 days, I think, for sure.
Okay. What's the level of certainty that you – what's the – not certainty, confidence, Ed. What's your level of confidence in this?
I think it's very high. I think it's about – on a scale of 1 to 10, I would say it's about an 8. I think we're looking at a pretty high confidence forecast here, especially, you know, this weekend. We might get a little break – briefly in the northern and central belt here midweek next week, maybe taking that temperature down a little bit. But in the extended range, later next week, next weekend, and into kind of the middle of the month, there's going to be a pretty big ridge of high pressure that's going to set up here across the plain states. And that really bolsters our confidence with respect to those temperatures. And it really comes down to how this precipitation pattern decides to play out with respect to how this impacts things.
So this ridge that you're talking about, is this the dome of doom for the Midwest that I used to write about all the time?
You know, it is a pretty impressive dome of high pressure. I wouldn't call it the dome of doom for everybody. I think kind of the way I guess you could categorize that would be, where's the core of the heat, right? If it's over Iowa, Missouri, Illinois, like it was in 2012 for a lot of the time, that would be the dome of doom, as you say, right? But I think moving forward here, the core is a little bit further south and west. It's down in the western, southwestern plains and into the Four Corners region, but it's pretty expansive. So that's kind of allowing for this heat to kind of spread out a little bit. Maybe it's not 102 degrees in Iowa, but instead we have a very broad area of above normal temperatures, let's say upper 80s to lower to middle 90s in those areas. So it's definitely a more expansive ridge because, again, it's going to be a pretty good one here over the next 10 days or so.
Okay, that's temperatures for the 10 days. The forecast that I'm looking at doesn't include a whole lot of rain for that time period either, Ed. What are you seeing?
Right. Yeah, that's exactly right. And what usually happens with these domes are on the periphery of those domes. And that's why it's so important to know where the center of it is, right? So the periphery is going to be running from the southern prairies into the Dakotas, maybe into Minnesota. So those areas to the north, I think, are going to do pretty well in the rainfall department. Now, further south, the further south you go, you get towards I-80, and especially even south towards I-70, that's where it's going to be a lot harder for those storms to kind of penetrate through that ridge. And that's why to the north, I think, is going to have a much better chance here through the middle of the month for appreciable precipitation.
Right. Ridge rider storms if they stay to the north there. So watch that closely. Okay. Can we step out to the second half of July? What are you thinking?
Sure. Yeah. Good. So, again, I think this – yeah, go ahead, Chip.
No, I'm just – does the heat stick around into the second half?
I think it does, largely. Again, it's very important to kind of track where this ridge kind of travels, because if we can get this to kind of shift a little bit south and west over time, that could introduce at least better precipitation odds in places where we're going to really need it, whether that's Nebraska, Iowa, Illinois, Indiana, Ohio. But generally speaking, this entire pattern is driven by what we call the global wind, and it's in a negative state right now, and it's one that favors that warmth to kind of continue through through the month of July. So as long as we have that negative global wind, which I think we're going to for quite a while here, I think it's wise to expect above normal temperatures here continuing through pretty much most of the month. Again, we might have a couple ups and downs that kind of help us out a little bit, but I think generally here, it does look like a pretty warm pattern right through the end of the month.
Okay, pretty warm pattern. You know, we are in the middle of the Corn Belt, call it Iowa, Illinois. What are the risks that we're going to be in that 95-degree range in that July 15 to July 25 time frame?
You know, I think it's all going to come down to timing, right? You know, we're seeing these little oscillations back and forth, and we're kind of seeing it next week. We're going to be really warm here for the holiday weekend. And then if you look at your forecast locally, it's probably going to dip down a little bit middle of next week. You know, so those types of things are very tough to predict at a 3 to 4 week lead time.
Sure.
But generally speaking, I can't rule out some of that heat at times in those areas you mentioned. I think it's more like 88 to 92 a lot of the time, but we could definitely have a couple days here and there that, you know, surge past that into the middle and even upper 90s.
Sure. Okay. Rainfall. I would assume that if that ridge is going to stay in place, that we're still going to be looking at those ridge rider storms that can develop, but mm-hmm. might keep us. Boy, if we stay dry over the next 10 days and that dryness gets us into the second half of the month, Ed, that does start to become worrisome.
Sure. Yeah. And it's certainly a concern we have, especially in the, let's call it from western Iowa westward into the plains where that ridge is a little bit more solidified. So it's the areas that I just mentioned there, you know, western Iowa, Missouri, westward, that I think have the best long-term issues here with respect to dryness. The further north and east you go across the belt, as that ridge kind of flexes up and down, we should, like you said there, kind of get some of those ridge riders back into the pattern. But it all comes down to coverage. If we're working with, you know, 40 to 50% coverage, you know, you can conclude what you like from that. But it is going to be hit or miss here, I think, through most of the month, as long as that ridge continues to be in place.
Gotcha. What else is on your watch list right now, Ed?
You know, I think it's really this global wind and how this progresses into the month of August. Obviously, as we get deeper into August, it becomes more of a soybean story. And I think over time here, as long as this negative global wind continues, there's a lot of research that does back warmth kind of lingering into the month of August. Now, how this kind of plays out is really the important part. If we can kind of adjust this ridge a little bit to the south and perhaps to the west, maybe it's not all that bad. But
right.
I think that's really what we're going to have to be focused on through this month of July here, because I think it's going to have a really big impact into August.
What's the source of this ridge? Are we still transitioning from El Nino to La Nina?
Yep, exactly right. And
okay.
When you have this negative global wind, that's more of a La Nina-like background state. So when that happens, you do tend to get these ridges that do kind of come up, and then they may linger for a little while because that background state is not something that just flips like a light switch. So it's a situation where if we do see a trend, it's going to take time to do so. And that's why, you know, when we see this in some of our long range commentary, you know, it's tough to really shake that general broad warmth idea because the La Nina background state supports it. Yep.
Gotcha. Hey, fantastic work, Ed. Appreciate you making the time for us this morning and bringing your weather outlook to us. I wish you had a little bit better news for us, but it is what it is. That's all that it can be.
That's right. I really appreciate the opportunity, Chip. Great talking
you to bet. You bet. Hey, have a great 4th of July weekend, Ed.
Likewise, my friend. We'll talk soon, all right?
Sounds great. That is Ed Valley, Empire Weather Consulting. All right, let's make some flags. We're going to be talking with Jeff Schauber from Valley Forge Flags next on AgriTalk.
Our name says it all. AgriTalk. What more do you need to know?
Yeah. stepping step on this.
Break it, break it, break it, down, 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 dangle. Roger, over.
I feel bad stepping on that. That is just, that puts a smile on your face right there.
Yeah, yeah. I'm bebopping. There's movement. There's movement.
Welcome back to AgriTalk. Glad that you could join us today. Wow, what a great job by Ed Valley, Empire Weather, explaining what's going on out there. It's
you bet.
It's going to be dicey. It's going to be dicey going through the month of July here. We need to pay attention to it and pay very close attention to it. Okay, I'm really looking forward to this. We got Jeff Schauber on the phone with us. He is with Valley Forge Flags, joins us right now. Jeff, thanks for making time for us this morning. How you doing?
Doing pretty good. Kind of here at the end of our patriotic season here with the 4th of July upon us, and very busy. It's been a very high demand year for flags. A lot of patriotic people out there, and quite frankly, I haven't seen this demand since just after 9/11. I've been with the company for 27 years, and this is the second time I've seen things like this. Not quite the surge of demand like after 9/11, but we are oversold on many of our core U.S. SKUs, and it's good to see for the country. It's you know, stressful and frustrating as a supplier trying to you know, fill your dealer's demands, but that's where we're at, and you know, I guess it's a good thing.
Oh, Jeff, that gives me hope. What you just described right there, it gives me hope. If we can get a resurgence of that patriotic feeling in this country, that will do us all some good, don't you think?
I agree with you 100%, and I assure you that it is happening, okay? And it's, you know, it's a result of a lot of things. I mean, it started off with the COVID virus thing. People, you know, staying at home, you know, focusing on their home, improving their properties. Some of the major retailers were still open. Obviously, Amazon was still open, and people putting flagpoles in the ground at their houses and off their house. And I, you know, some of it's that, and I think some of it's a reaction to what you're seeing on the news media with the social unrest and whatnot, and a fair amount of people just want to be patriotic and show their support for our country.
Man, Jeff, that makes me feel good. That gives me some hope. Tell us about the Valley Forge flags. How long has it been around?
Valley Forge flag probably was incorporated in the early 1900s. Maybe, you know, was in existence in the late 1800s. We were predominantly a supplier to the federal government for many, many years, a government contractor. It's fourth generation, family owned. We were manufacturing in Pennsylvania, near the Valley Forge area, as far west as Wilmelsdorf, Pennsylvania. Our headquarters are still in Wyomissing, Pennsylvania. But we operate five facilities, factories, sewing factories, and printing factories in South Carolina now, and ship out of South Carolina, distribute from South Carolina. And we have one sewing facility in near Huntsville, Alabama.
But all so right here in the U.S. of A, huh?
Yeah. Matter of fact, everything that absolutely every U.S. flag that we made is 100% sourced in the USA. No components from anywhere other than the USA.
Well, let's talk about those components.
Sure.
Yeah. What are they made of?
Okay. So probably the most popular flag material is 200 denier DuPont nylon. Okay. It's a good combination of flyability and wearability. A little bit longer lasting material is the 2-ply spun polyester, and that will outlast the nylon flag about 15 to 30% in the same weather conditions in the wind and whatnot. And what's unique about that that spun polyester is that cotton is spun also to make the fibers. So this polyester flag looks a lot like a cotton flag.
Really?
But of course, the synthetic fibers, they outlast the cotton.
Sure.
Now, cotton is still a material that we use to make a lot of flags. Predominantly, the cotton is, you know, it's a traditional flag material. Very, very, you know, prevalent right up through the 60s. And then at that point, some of the synthetics started to take over because they last longer outside.
Sure.
In the wind, the rain, I mean, the sun, that's all enemies to the flag. And it takes a beating, you know, in the weather. But the cotton flags, specifically for ceremonial uses, you know, predominantly the 5x9.5 with the casket flag for the veterans, and service members, police and whatnot. A 3x5 flag is given to a veterans at retirement. And, you know, most of those are kept in shadow boxes and whatnot, keepsakes for the family members and, you know, display in somebody's office and things like that. But there are some still flown outside, and some people feel like that traditional material is the material of choice.
Yeah, and you are sourcing that cotton from the U.S., right?
Oh, absolutely. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, right from I'm not real familiar with upstream, you know, when we get it, but it is absolutely, and has to be. All of our flags are tagged 100% made in the USA, and to be a supplier to the federal government like we were, that is a requirement. That flag has to be 100% sourced in the United States.
Yeah, and can we, you know, it'd be kind of cool if we could trace it right back to the farm, wouldn't it?
It would be. It would be.
Yeah.
I don't know exactly how that's done, but that, you know, which farm, what area it's grown and things like that, you know, that would be.
Yeah, no doubt about it. Okay, so I can't believe it, Jeff. We are out of time. Thank you for sharing your story with us about Valley Forge flags. And I tell you what, your message pumped me up going into the weekend here, Jeff. So encouraging. It fills me with hope.
Well, I'm happy to deliver that message, and I appreciate this opportunity to be on your show, and wish you all the best, safe Independence Day.
Where do we go to learn more about Valley Forge flags?
Well, you can go to our website, and you can find our resellers that are listed on that website, and that's www.valleyforgeflag.com.
Valleyforgeflag.com. Jeff, thank you so much. Appreciate it. That is Jeff Schauber from Valley Forge Flags. You got to come back this afternoon, everybody. We're going to have a conversation with Jim McCormick from agmarket.net. And tomorrow morning, we'll be here, free for all, Wiesmeyer, Johnson, and Haney, right here on AgriTalk.